And if you're just tuning in, we're backed up like an airport at Christmas. Well, maybe we're backed up like an airport at Thanksgiving 36 years ago tonight when D.B. Cooper pulled off the only unsolved skyjacking in world history. And we'll talk more about that with Galen Cook. We're holding him over from the first hour. He's a lawyer. He's been building his case toward who he thinks D.B. Cooper is. We'll find out in just a moment. But then Robert Young Pelton is kind enough to hold on for a second. License to Kill is his book, Hired Guns in the War on Terror. I read it this week. And the perspective that it will give you, the inside look at the mercenaries, the soldiers of fortune, the private contractors, the people who are doing the heavy lifting right now in Iraq and Afghanistan and getting paid privately just what they can and can't do, how it's changing the world. We'll get an insider's perspective on that coming up later on this hour. If you missed last hour's crypto news, it's on my blog. If you go to coasttocoastam.com, you can find out more there about the cell phone surveillance that's starting up. The Marilyn Manson story was very interesting in the continued search for just what is it that's missing in Baker County here in Florida, where I'm broadcasting from tonight. Is it a skunk ape? And that reminds me, too, that there's a book called The Shy Creatures. David Mack, who illustrated Daredevil and other things for Marvel, has a new book out called The Shy Creatures. It's a children's book. It's perfect for holiday gift giving. He's agreed to come on and be a guest coming up in the weeks ahead. You can either, you know, search that anywhere on the web, The Shy Creatures, David Mack at Amazon or whatever, or you can go to last week's crypto news blog and you can find the link I put up there for it. Terrific book. Just got it this week. Enjoyed it quite a bit. And so we'll get back to just who it is that was behind this unsolved skyjacking next with Galen Cook and your calls on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. Okay, we got a couple of people lined up to talk with you too, but I think we set the table sufficiently. Galen Cook, the lawyer who's been working on the case of D.B. Cooper here on the night of the 36th anniversary of his jump with how much money? $200,000 in cash?
$200,000 in 20s.
Okay.
21 pounds.
Now, how much of it was eventually found, by the way?
Okay, now that's part of the evidence. You want me to go into that just a little bit?
Well, I'll leave the scenario up to you. If you want to go deep into that or just take it from there, that's fine. I just want to make sure we don't get too far behind so that we biggest, can't discuss your suspect.
Certainly the biggest clue in the case. By the way, if D.B. Cooper happens to be listening tonight, and I would concur, you pick some great bumper music, Ian. Flying on a Jet Plane and Jump by Van Halen, perfect stuff.
we're too clever by half.
It was great. Now, listen, one other thing. The FBI made arrangements with the Air Force out of McCord Air Force Base that night to send up two fighters that had radar tracking capability because they wanted to zero in on where Cooper was going to jump. But this goes partly to my theory. Cooper, probably being smart enough to know there was going to be people chasing the airplane, and if he deployed a chute, as soon as he got out of the aircraft, it was going to be real easy for those fighters to track him on radar. And my theory, basically, through a lot of research of my own, is that Cooper did what they called a halo jump.
Yeah, I know what that is. It's a high altitude, low opening. Yeah, that was in the book I was reading this week on License to Kill. I felt so cool there. Yeah, so you think he did a halo jump?
Yeah, that's my theory, and the reason I did that, I talked with a lot of Vietnam War vets who also worked in the CIA. Now, as we know, the CIA used their own transport system in Southeast Asia during the Vietnam War era, and there is evidence to show that some of those paratroopers who were trained by the FBI actually jumped out of 727s. And the reason they used 727s down there was because they were fast, they could get into small airports, and because they had a belly opening, the rear door exit, and it allowed for cargo as well as jumpers to get out of there. And they had to insert agents behind enemy lines, probably in Laos and Cambodia, and they did what was called a halo jump. Now, these guys could jump out, and most of these jumps were at night, and they were at 10,000 feet. And you get about 40 to 45 seconds of free fall before you pull the ripcord. And that's the other reason Cooper needed a wrist altimeter, because it was dark that night and it was stormy. But he wanted to beat any kind of radar tracking that might be in the area, and a halo jump would beat it. Of course, this is speculative, but my theory is that Cooper came from the ranks of these specially trained CIA operatives who were paratroopers, probably with the Army, and they were very skilled at halo jumping, and they knew how to jump out of 727s. And that's why I think Cooper, on that night, made sure that the airline he was going to hijack was using a 727, because that was the only commercial jet that would provide him with a getaway.
That's very interesting. So he jumps, he waits, he does a low opening. So how high up off the ground do you think before he yanked the ripcord?
I talked with a parachutist who's got over 5,000 jumps, told him the scenario, and he said he agreed that that would be about the only way to avoid radar detection, because those old canopies were 28 feet in diameter that light up the radar screen. But with a free fall, and he'd reach a terminal speed of around 120 to 130, he could fall for about 40 to 45 seconds before he pulled the ripcord, and that would get him on the ground quickly, and this guy was trained. He knew what he was doing, and he could survive out there, and the only reason he hijacked this airplane was because he wanted that money, and he wanted to get away with it.
Now, I understand that, but again, like, how high up, though, are we talking about? 2,000 feet, 3,000 feet? At what point would he have had to open the parachute? And what about the trees? I mean, that's something we've heard repeatedly about the story of D.B. Cooper,
yeah,
is that he would have landed in the heavily forested area and very likely been sort of skewered on a tree.
Well, there, of course, it's speculation as to where he landed. I think the earlier people looking for him got it wrong in location. But to answer your first question, 2,000 feet would be sufficient.
Okay.
Now, some of the agents think that he jumped and landed somewhere around Woodland, Washington, or even closer to Ariel, which is about 20 to 30 miles north of Portland. The work I've done on this, fixed with the other known factors about the wind direction that night, I feel puts Cooper more in the area of west of Vancouver and a little bit northwest of Portland, right near the Columbia River. Some agents think he actually fell into the river, and possibly the reason why there was almost $6,000 in money found in 1980 on the Columbia River is because Cooper either went into the drink or he saw that he was about to, and he had to cut the line that was holding the money, that was tethering his money, and so he got separated from his cash that night, saved his life, but lost the money, and then the money was found about 9 years later, or at least part of it.
At least part of it.
Yeah.
So, all right, so then he lands safely in your theory. You think he's CIA trained. He can do a halo jump. Maybe, you know, special forces, special ops in Vietnam, that narrows you down to an actual suspect?
Well, you're getting into my deep personal investigation, and I'm not at this time ready to release any names. I have a suspect, and I've been watching this person for a long time, and he not only fits the characteristics of what Mr. Cooper did and was capable of doing, but it also fits the personal profile of the person who did this too. And fortunately, this person is still alive, so I can't give a name. However, this person does fit the profile to a T, and I believe Mr. Cooper survived that jump that night, and he got away. I don't believe he had the money with him when he got away, but I believe he got away with his life.
All right, so you're going to have to do better than that, though. Tell us a little bit more about why you suspect this person, that if you won't name names, narrow it down for us on why this person fits your profile.
Okay, the reason I won't name names, first of all, is because he's living, and it could create some liability for me. However, I'll tell you this. This person, first of all, fits the exact physical description that was described by the witnesses. We're looking at a guy about between 5'10 and 6', 175 pounds, dark complexion, clean cut, used intelligent language. The person I have as a suspect lived in the area, was a college graduate of the area. And when I say the area, I would say in the Portland or Northern Oregon area. This person spent about 4 years in Vietnam in the military as a paratrooper. In fact, he was doing the kinds of things that I described earlier regarding these halo jumps. It was secret ops type of jumps, very skilled in it. For some of the reasons I can't go into personally, he also fits the profile in terms of his personal, too. We're looking at a person, Ian, who tends to be a loner. This person wasn't married. And also, he probably had a little bit of a tendency to being dishonest and stealing, too. Someone who commits this kind of crime may have had a past record, or maybe in this case he had some personal problems and he was making a last ditch attempt to get away with something that hadn't been done before and put a bunch of money in his pocket.
All right, now what? How did you get turned on to this guy as a suspect?
Been looking at this case for a long time, and I believe this person. Some of the things I can't tell you, I'm just not able to tell you right now, not because I don't want to, but it's still an ongoing investigation. And I will tell you this, I've had some communication with an FBI agent in Seattle about this particular individual, and the FBI has taken an interest in this person now. They've told me, and they said it's one of the best they've seen, but they're not willing to tell me straight up whether it's the guy or not. So it leads me to believe he's high up on the FBI suspect list, but the suspect list is long. There's over 1,000 people on the list. So I've had confirmation from an agent in Seattle who was actually in charge of the Cooper case tell me it was one of the best he's seen, and he told me that if this Cooper case is ever to be solved, it probably won't be the FBI that solves it. It'll be someone out there who's a civilian who has been working on this case,
okay,
like myself and probably dozens of others, Ian.
That doesn't tell me how you came across him.
This person, yes, I understand that. This person lived in Alaska at one time. I'm originally from Alaska, and I met this person, and he had told me all about the jumps he had made in Vietnam as a special ops person. I was quite a bit younger when this happened, but I remember that distinctly. And I'll tell you this, Ian, about 3 days after the hijacking in 1971, in every newspaper in the United States, there was a composite FBI drawing of D.B. Cooper. And when I saw the picture of the composite, there was no doubt in my mind that this was the guy. That's what really did it, was that composite drawing of D.B. Cooper. And then I had to go and do my own research from there. But the composite drawing is taken from the eyewitnesses on the night of that hijacking, and it really, things haven't changed on that composite. The FBI believes that's a good
an accurate drawing. Let's go west to the Rockies, where Larry is in Reno on Coast to Coast AM for Galen Cook. Larry?
Yeah, hi there. You know, I worked up at SeaTac International. I know your guest knows the airport well up there. I remember seeing that Northwest jet sitting off there in the dark. They were afraid to do too much interaction with it at the time. But your guest, if he recalls, security matters have changed over the years. And if I recall, Mr. Cooper also wanted, I think you mentioned 170 kilometers, or it was about 200 miles per hour, to allow those rear stairs to come down without the wind current preventing that. At that time, to drop those stairs would be just a matter of taking a lever and releasing it. And with the wind speed greatly reduced, that would allow him to use that for an access. After that time, I recall, and correct me if I'm wrong with your guest, some sort of a thin metal flange was simply attached to the underside of the fuselage. And as the wind current would increase in flight, it would simply flap that across the opening of the stair seam there to prevent that any time in the future. Is that
so? They retrofitted something to keep somebody from replicating that that successful jump.
Yeah, it was so simple, just to pop a lever if you knew if you were going slow enough. Wind speed and aircraft speed that you could pop that down easily, it would probably remain up to a degree, but certainly drop down far enough for anybody to make a jump. And this was just a simple device. I believe a mechanic for one of the airlines came up with, you know, if we're talking a 50-cent part.
And thank you, Larry. I appreciate that. That's very interesting. Let's go east of the Rockies where Don is in Ohio for Galen Cook, who's researching D.B. Cooper. Short of giving us a name, Don, he's narrowed it down a bit. Where are you with that?
Oh, I'm going to ask a quick question. Just by the way, earlier when I was listening, I remember that a few hours ago, I wished my brother happy birthday. He's born on November 24th, 1971, so
that's all right.
Kind of weird. But the question I had was there any damage outside the plane? Did anybody ever notice any damage or anything? And I'll take my answer off the air.
Okay.
By the way, to comment on that earlier caller, That device they installed was called the Cooper Vane. It was just a little mechanical device that prevented the stairs from deploying in mid-flight. The question your last caller asked was about the damage done to the plane. The only damage was when that plane landed in Reno, when the plane slowed down for landing, the stairwell came down a little bit too, and so there were sparks lighting up the runway at Reno when it came down, but there wasn't that much damage because 10 hours later, they took that 727 and flew it back to Minneapolis.
And so how long do you think before you'll be able to name this man whom you think of as the prime suspect to be D.B. Cooper? What is his health like? How old is he? And when do you think you will be able to solve this mystery?
Well, there may be someone that beats me to solving it, and I that would be fine. There's a lot of people still working on it. This person I'm looking at is about 66 years old right now, and some people say he's too young because he would have only been about 30 when he committed the crime, and a lot of people believe that Cooper was more like 40 or 45. But then you go back and look at some of the investigation work done by other agents earlier, such as Ralph Himmelsbach, and he says in his book, which is titled Norjack, that Cooper could have been anywhere between 30 and 50. So really, I can't tell you when I could name this person, but the problem is linking physical evidence to the suspect. Now, the FBI claims that they have DNA, and I talked with an agent here a couple weeks ago, and they said they got DNA off his tie, his necktie, which he left behind on seat 18E. And I asked the agent, I said, well, how'd you get DNA? And he said it was off skin cells. So they apparently are using that now as one possible way to eliminate suspects, but not sure that that's the method that may be that actually does it. Some people wonder if it was even actually Cooper's tie. I don't know. I don't have that evidence. But
We'll just have to leave that there for now and know that the conversation will continue. Very much enjoyed talking about this 36th anniversary of D.B. Cooper tonight. And we'll, I'm sure, have some very interesting follow-up email about this next week, and I'll share that. And so be listening, Galen Cook. And who knows, maybe somebody will confess between now and then. I confess that I'm grateful to Robert Young Pelton for being so patient. Hang on for License to Kill next on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. Well, it's not just Blackwater. Companies like Triple Canopy, Halliburton, DynCorp, they all have these independent contractors, these private contractors, these soldiers for hire contractors that have their own creed. There's a statement on this at the beginning of the book, License to Kill, Hired Guns in the War on Terror, Robert Young Pelton, coming up in just a second. But I thought I'd read it to you because in and of itself, of course, it's informative, if not definitive. And here's how it reads, the contractor's creed. I am a U.S. contractor. I look out for myself, the operators to my left and right, and no one else. I'll always take advantage of the fact that I can finally tell military officers to pound sand, and I will do so at every opportunity. I am my country's scapegoat, the plausible deniability warrior, and I love it. Less than $700 a day is unacceptable. I am trained to eat things that would make a billy goat puke, but will refuse anything less than $60 per diem because I am greedy. I care not for ribbons and awards for valor. I do this job for the opportunity to kill the enemies of my country and to finally get that boat I've always wanted. I will be in better shape than 99% of the active duty personnel, although this is not hard. I will equip myself with the latest high-speed gear, and I will trick out my M4 until it weighs more than 24 pounds, not because it works better, but because it looks cool in the photographs. I will carry more weapons, ammunition, and implements of death on my person than an infantry fire team, and when engaged, I will lay waste to everything around me. In any combat zone, I will always locate the swimming pool, the beer, and women, because I can. I will deploy on my terms, and if it ever gets too stupid, I will simply find another company that pays me more. This is an email that gets circulated on private contractor channels. How much of it is tongue-in-cheek, and how much of it reveals the truth of these soldiers for hire currently at work in Afghanistan, in Iraq, on behalf, of our country? Next, on Coast to Coast AM, this is Ian Punnett. I would say about half of the time, for whatever reason, at least in my head, if not out loud, I refer to you as Robert Pelton Young, and I don't know why. I've always transposed those two names on there. Nice to talk with you again.
That's a pleasure.
So if I slip again and I do that, forgive me in advance. I think the last time we talked was about your Dangerous Places book, wasn't it?
Yeah. Well, it's I tend to multitask, so between doing documentaries and writing books, I alternate between sort of more specific books like License to Kill and then my sort of killer 1,000-page guide to all the world's war zones, which is the world's most dangerous places.
Yeah, that was very interesting. And I was kind of hearing echoes of Dangerous Places in this because I remember you talking about how you could move fairly easily amongst what would be considered friendlies and enemies of the United States based on your reputation and the way in which you were able to win the trust of people and have them talk honestly about the situations they found themselves in these dangerous places. And I could see that at work here with these soldiers, these private contractors that were telling you things which they may not have told a journalist from CNN.
Well, I think I have a strange reputation because, you know, for example, when I'm with the Afghans, they remember me from when the Taliban were in power, and, you know, I've been going there since 95, and a lot of the contractors remember me from the war, from the fighting in Afghanistan. I was with a special forces team in the north with General Dostum, and I think there's a sense of wanting to go on record with someone that, you know, has a longer sort of sight or longer vision than just whoever's in power for the next 4 years. So hopefully when I write my books, it really doesn't matter whether you like right wing, left wing, or whatever. You just want the truth to go down on paper.
Yeah, you know what, though? I think that's sort of the interesting thing about the way that sold these guys, and I guess I should be careful to not refer to them as soldiers because they're private contractors as opposed to, say, U.S. regular army or something, and I know that that might be some sort of sensitive definition, but I think it's interesting that they seem willing to tell you things which they know has no particular PR spin to it. It doesn't sound good, the way they tell these stories. It just sounds truthful.
Well, you know, a funny example was when I was with Blackwater in Baghdad, and I lived with them for a month doing the airport run. There was a guy named T-Boy, who dressed all in black and had multiple skulls tattooed on himself, on his gear, you name it. And most of these guys were a little standoffish at first, and he didn't say anything. And about a week into my time there, he finally comes to me and says, "Hey, you're the guy. You're the guy." I mean, what do you mean? "You're the guy." He says, "You wrote that book." I said, "What are you talking about?" He said, "You wrote the book that convinced me to join the Marines."
Uh-huh.
World's most dangerous places. So to a lot of these guys, I mean, we get along quite well because they kind of want to be like me when they grow up, and I want to learn more about them. And I think I do people the respect and the honesty that they deserve regardless of what they do. And I think that's ultimately in history what you want to understand about a certain time and place and person, that, you know, their motivations and what were they doing, what were they thinking. So
right.
That gets good friends.
I think it does, and it's an interesting revelation that comes through on what these guys are thinking and how they look at their work and whether or not we as a country really are ready for the truth on this, which is a kind of a separate discussion. But let's, again, say we're talking about the book License to Kill, Hired Guns in the War on Terror. So let's define the companies. We talk about Blackwater, you just mentioned, but Triple Canopy is one that people don't know probably as much about.
Yeah, when I wrote the book, you have to remember, I started to write this book 4 years ago. I mean, Blackwater just hit the news, you know, in Fallujah a few years ago and just recently sort of came into the open. But I wanted to pick the companies that I thought would define the marketplace. In other words, Blackwater's at the extreme end in terms of the amount of violence they dealt out. I wanted to pick one that I thought was sort of in the middle of the road, and I wanted to pick one that was very conservative. So I chose Triple Canopy because it was mostly Delta and Special Forces guys as sort of the middle ground, and I chose Heart Security, which is an English company, as sort of the lighter touch, politically correct version of a private security company.
And so you're exploring each of these different things of the Blackwater part. And I want to talk a little bit more about Fallujah next hour because it's a longer discussion. But I think the Blackwater part was really interesting because you're going to trace the origins of the company to where it is now. And at least from my ear, and tell me this is wrong, but it sure seems like the beginning, they might have had higher standards for who they would consider to join these small groups of, as you say, you know, that were doling out a lot of violence. And then as the need grew, the criteria changed and the standards were lowered. And that may account for why we had some of the problems later on. Would that be fair?
Yeah, but you have to remember, Iraq is an unusual war because of the number of IEDs. And let's say you come out of a tier one background, and in other words, your dev crew or your special forces or Delta, and you've been trained in all these very high-level combat skills, that's not going to keep you alive in Iraq. What's going to keep you alive is not getting blown up. And most of these smart guys started off in the first, you know, tour, second tour, third tour, realizing that it was just a matter of time before they got blown up. And most of those guys drifted away into less sort of dangerous work. And then that's mostly been taken over by Marines and ex-cops. And I won't say those are lower caliber or lower standards of people, but they're not the same people that hold their finger off the trigger for a long period of time.
Yeah, I think that's a really interesting point. I want you to spend a little time on that. Talk about the history of Blackwater as a company and how, you know, people like Billy Waugh, who you quote at the beginning of the book, and others, how those types of private security firms were looking for a certain type of soldier to begin with, mm-hmm. and where they've gone from there.
Well, it's funny. I was just listening to your D.B. Cooper piece, and he was talking about guys that worked as contractors in the 60s in the dirty war of Laos and whatever. And they were a unique breed. They were people that had experience in Vietnam, some of them going back to Korea, World War II. And these were guys who, you know, had a sense of comfort in the military, and they loved the hit, the adrenaline rush, the camaraderie, the sense of doing something important. And then when they got out of the military, a lot of them just turned into drunks. I mean, they just couldn't handle reality. So they drifted back into what was then sort of the old boy network. And just to be clear to your readers, Billy Waugh is the world's oldest contractor. He was sent at age 73 into Afghanistan to find bin Laden, but he'd been actually signed up in World War II and had been working as a contractor in the 60s, 70s, and 80s, and even tracked bin Laden in Sudan under Kofor Black, under the CIA station chief. And these are guys that can't exist outside of that adrenaline-filled world. So those guys were basically dinosaurs in the 90s. And a lot of people forget that, you know, we fought an entire war, let's say in Laos, what they call White Star, using commercial entities like Air America and hiring guys who wore Hawaiian shirts and, you know, special forces rings and went around calling themselves contractors or businessmen. And we managed to conduct a war for years without people really even knowing what we were doing over there. That was all shut down by a couple of commissions, what they call a Church Pike Commission, which said that you can't really just hire people to go running around killing people and fighting wars without Congress having some kind of oversight. And that really sort of shut down the sort of private side of covert activities. Well, on September 11th, we were faced with a unique problem. We had been downsizing the military because of the end of the Soviet era, and we were trying to retransform it into a sort of a lighter, more expedition type of structure. On September, I think it was 13th or 14th, Kofor Black was sitting down, and they said, we need to launch a mission into Afghanistan. Well, they didn't have enough people, and the CIA had to then tap into guys like Billy Waugh and go into the Old Boys Network, which essentially combined what they call sheep-dipping active military folks, which is somebody that's like he's active military, is then told he's going to go work for the CIA, and he has something written in his dossier that has nothing to do with what he's actually doing. Or they hired guys who used to be something, you know, Special Forces, Dev Group, who then suit up and head over to Afghanistan and work as what they call green badgers. The CIA has two kinds of people. The blue badgers are the full-time employees, and green badgers are the freelancers. And they went off looking for bin Laden, you know, essentially hiring and training mercenary armies and doing exactly what we did in the 60s. Well, that wouldn't have been that unusual, except that part of the process of fighting in Afghanistan was to construct and protect a new government. So when Karzai was put into power, he was given a group of SEAL Team 6 or DevGru bodyguards who at a wedding in Kandahar had to save Karzai's life but ended up gunning down two innocent civilians and the assassin. And a decision was made that we need a little lighter touch. So they went to an ex-Delta Force guy named Craig Maxim, and he put together what was essentially the third freelancer commercial PSD or private security detail. And from that point forward, they began to solve all their problems by simply going into the private sector. Blackwater's first job was essentially providing security for the CIA at a base in Shkin, which was the southern part of the search for bin Laden, and that was the farthest the Pegasus helicopter could fly without refueling. And at that time, Buzzy Krongard had just come back and said, gee, they're running out of guys. They need more people. So Eric Prince said, well, I run a training facility. I got a lot of buddies from the teams, and I can put together a group of a dozen guys, and we can get over there, you know, within a few weeks. That was Blackwater's first gig. And from that point, we then went to Bremer. And as you know, Bremer showed up shortly after the UN was bombed, and they put together the largest, most impressive private security detail, which is about 64 guys, four helicopters, armored vehicles, old Mamba anti-mine vehicles. And that's when we started this whole idea of a private citizen, Bremer, being protected by 64 private citizens driving through the streets of Baghdad using their guns like car horns to clear traffic. And that's when people first thought, who are these people? And it was actually Fallujah, in which four employees on a new commercial contract that Blackwater had got lost, were led into Fallujah by an Iraqi sort of civilian police detail and then assassinated. And that video was sent around the world of their bodies being hacked and hung from the bridge.
Right.
And that
right.
was some people realized what these guys were up to.
Well, let's hold on to Fallujah again till next hour, but I'm so glad you set the table on Blackwater and Triple Canopy is another one, as you mentioned, and some of these other companies. The key here, though, is that they operate outside of what of our national expectation of our own soldiers or Marines. And they seem to have, and this is an area which I enjoyed the discussion of in your book, but it's something which we have yet to settle as a society at large. they seem to operate in these gray areas of respectability, maybe, in terms of how they act.
It's much simpler than that.
Okay.
People sort of pause when they say, well, sort of gray areas. Well, it's deliberately set up that way. If you remember, we talked about White Star in Laos with Air America, right, and these guys with Hawaiian shirts and beer bellies and special forces rings. They deliberately operated in a gray area because when they were captured, you remember Eugene Hassenfuss, the guy that was caught in Nicaragua kicking things out of the door of a cargo plane?
Yeah.
And, you know, well, I was just a civilian. I was just hired to come here. It's like, no, you work for the CIA as a contractor.
Right.
So that mindset carried over into this new world. And it's even down to the way they dress. They dress, you know, that sort of 5'11 gear and all the thigh holster and whatever is exactly how CIA paramilitaries dress in the Special Activities Division. There's a genealogy there that people don't really see because it comes from the covert side of the operations.
But they are private citizens, though, with a license to kill.
And that's exactly the problem, because I wouldn't put the ability to use lethal force in your hands. That's normally the domain of the police or the military. And the reason it's in the hands of the military and the police is because that's the state. That's the voters determining who should have the right to end someone else's life. And on top of that, there's a number of laws and restrictions that give that person, whether it's a policeman or a soldier, the ability to pull that trigger and end someone's life. As soon as you put that in the hands of a private citizen and you take away any mechanism to prosecute them or to provide accountability or oversight, you now have a rogue element in society.
And that, or should we say, a rogue element in somebody else's society.
Well, that's even more appropriate, but don't forget that Blackwater operates both domestically and internationally, and these other companies are the first people they call when there's a disaster, like a hurricane or whatever. And we're just beginning this new era of privatized violence.
Okay, we're going to talk about the domestic part of that, too, because that's an intriguing idea. This idea of license to kill, because this comes up a lot, and I read the contractor's creed, mm-hmm. and these independent contractors, these private security personnel, they seem very pleased with the idea that they can just kill people.
Well, you kind of have to sit back and take a pause and think about it this way. The people that are doing this are not crazy people. They're not criminals. It's not like the Dirty Dozen, you know, where they've been let out of prison and given a gun. These are all people with respectable careers in the military or the police. These are the same people that went and served our country in other wars, and a lot of them, you know, of course, Iraq. A lot of them are from small-town police departments. And these are people that you would trust with your life. Now, you put them in a situation called Iraq, which is the most insane country on this planet, in which there are no rules, and you tell them to keep this client alive from point A to point B. There are no rules to follow. I mean, they have rules of force, and they have rules of engagement, and they're allowed to do certain things. But if you're being shot at continuously, and people are putting car bombs and trying to blow you up, what do you do? I mean, there are no rules. There is no way for you to say, you're cheating, you broke the rules, I have to shoot you.
Well, okay. Yes, and yet, having read your book, License to Kill, Hired Guns in the War on Terror, I have to ask you, Robert Young Pelton, a difficult question about what it means in these guys' heads to have no rules and, as you said earlier, no accountability. They are part of our nation's plausible deniability. We can sit back and, as a country, we can say, fire those men. Those people they did their job wrong. We don't have to take responsibility for their actions. But what does that mean about the people that sign up for this? I think there's a lot of clues in the quotes in your book, and we'll talk about Fallujah, and we'll talk about the domestic aspect of Blackwater next on Coast to Coast AM.